I am so excited to talk about today's story, and I haven't told anyone this story out loud yet. I heard about this story on a few TikToks, and I had never heard about this before anywhere, and I've only seen it discussed on a few, like one 10-minute TikTok and then another where it was like a stitch to the whole like man versus bear conversation. And I was like, well, I really want to do a deep dive. And then I was so excited when I like researched this situation and this story of this incredible woman and what she went through. And I asked my friends, like, I was so excited about talking about it. I was like, hey, you guys want to know? Or do you want to wait for the pod? And they were like, we'll wait for the pod. And so I was like, ah! So then I was just like, okay, well, I guess I really will not get to talk about this until I record the episode. So that's where we're at right now. That's why this is called Till I Say It Out Loud, because I need to say things sometimes out loud. And this is going to be the first time I get to say, I get to talk through this incredible story to anyone is to this microphone sitting here. So let's get into it. This is the story of Allison Botha. It is a survivor story, and it is extremely, extremely triggering and extremely upsetting. But she ends up telling her own story, so she does survive. But I do want people to understand, whoever's listening, that she goes through some pretty extreme things. One of the reasons I had to talk about this story and that I was so shocked I'd never heard the survivor story before was because of the links this woman went to survive and what she had to overcome. It's just mind-blowing, but it gets pretty tough to talk about. Her injuries are pretty extensive, and she is sexually assaulted. So if that is not something that you can listen to, I understand, and this might not be the right episode for you because it does get pretty tough. But I can't wait to tell you her story. I use a few sources that are really, really awesome. The All That's Interesting article about Allison is by Danielle Tenning, and it was extremely helpful. And then Allison actually has a film that is about a 1-hour documentary where she tells her story in her own way, which is adorable. She's such a bright, optimistic, shining ray of light. And that documentary film is called Allison, and I got to watch it on Prime. Like, I didn't have to rent it or anything. So if you have Prime, you should watch it. It's wonderful. And it's well put together, and she narrates it, and then they have major players in the whole story interviewed throughout. It's just incredible. I also use a few other sources for some of the more logistical things, legal clarifications and things like that. And I'm going to list everything in our show notes. But we're going to start with understanding the state of rape in South Africa during this time, which was in the 90s when this happens. And she is a South African woman, and she was living there during what people consider the height of the rape crisis. It's still like an issue today. But I did some research to kind of understand how it was viewed at the time. So rape in South Africa during apartheid has always been a problem and a tool of colonialism and a tool of control. However, in the 1970s, as anxiety about crime at large grew higher, a quote-unquote rape crisis was named in South Africa in the 80s and the 90s. But unfortunately, this was racialized and used against Black citizens. And so instead of it being used as a way to do away with rape and trying to actually solve the problem, it was used as a tool to cast racist narratives on Black men and Black perpetrators and Black neighborhoods and justify stricter law and order policies. And so, of course, it was exploited. This would allow white perpetrators to offend without worrying about being prosecuted, especially because at the time, only about 10% of rapes were said to be reported. Such an incredibly low number. And so on top of that, police weren't trusted specifically by Black women who were seen as political sellouts if they were seen talking to an officer. And so it was just an extremely difficult time, as rape had not been taken seriously before this. And then, like, when crime was something being focused on at large, it started becoming like an issue that people were like, we need to stop all crimes and especially rape. But it was still not really dealt with in the correct way. I read a statistic that said 40% of women in South Africa were said to be raped at least once in their lifetime. That's nearly half of all women in South Africa. Considering how low the reporting is, that's obviously going to be like a guesstimation. And many will experience this horror more than once in their lifetime. So it was absolutely terrifying. So new attention of sexual violence during these years can also be explained by the rise of feminist anti-rape activism. But despite the concern starting in the 70s, there was little direct activism against rape within the country until the 90s. And so it was not until the 90s that the first anti-rape marches that were primarily organized by women's prayer groups and teachers unions were actually held in South Africa. And our story takes place in 1994. So Allison kind of faced this type of assault within the time period where it was still not really being handled well. So Allison Botha was born September 22nd, 1967 in Port Elizabeth, South Africa. And she spent most of her childhood living with her mother and her brother, and she had a normal life. She was head girl at her high school, and I think she ended up spending a few years traveling after graduation, and then she returned home to find a job as like an insurance broker. And she said in her documentary she really enjoyed doing that she didn't have huge dreams really to go do and be something large. Like, she was cool with just having a chill life, a regular job, and just having friends there at her job. December 18th, 1994 is when this attack took place. And Allison was 27 years old, and she was abducted near her home in South Africa. She was spending time at a beach with her friends throughout the day. So in South Africa in December, it's summer there, which was something she said in her documentary. And I was like, oh, I didn't even think about that, because I read December, I think like Christmas, I think like weather here where I live in Texas. And she said it was like a normal summer day, and she was just chilling with her friends at the beach. And so she had driven some of her friends, and they came home back to her place, I think. And they had like pizza and games. Like, it sounds like the best day. It just sounds like an amazing fun day with your friends, and you finish it out with pizza. And I even think I remember her describing it in the documentary, that like kind of the tightness of your skin after being in the sun and like being in the water and just like feeling like you had such a good day. So when people were leaving, she drove one of her friends home, and she said that when she returned, and I think her friend had like done some of her laundry, and so she'd taken her laundry with her in the front seat. And so when she returned home, her parking spot was gone at her apartment. And so she parked further down the street than she usually did, and it was a little darker than normal. And when she reached for the laundry to grab it and like pick it up and get up out of the car, she felt the door open and a gust of warm air pour into the car. And she felt a knife at her throat, and she heard a voice. And the voice basically said, "Move over or I'll kill you." Allison was 27 at this time. So she moved over into the front seat and he got in behind her and like got in the driver's seat. He said he didn't want to hurt her. Obviously a lie, because this story is harrowing. And he said, "I just need your car for an hour. My name is Clinton." She said in the documentary that she understands now that she should have jumped out of the car. But at the time, she said that she just didn't want to believe the worst. So she tried to believe that he was telling the truth and that if she just complied, that she would be okay. He asked her if she had a boyfriend and kind of made small talk, and that gave her a false sense of security. And so as they were driving, she was like, maybe it's going to be okay. And yet she was trapped in her own car as he drove to pick up his accomplice, and they were going to begin their plans for her. So it's not just going to be this one guy. There's going to be a second guy there. And so things are going to get real dark really fast. So the shift came for her when the second man entered the car, and he was much less charismatic than the man called Clinton who was driving the car. And she said that she could see the dead, cold, evil eyes in the rearview mirror because she was in the front seat. So he was behind her and she could see him like looking at her from the rearview mirror. That's when it dawned on her that she would not be going home, and terror overtook her. So Franz Dutoit, who is the man who called himself Clinton, and Tiens Kruger were her captors. They would later be known as the Ripper Rapists. They had a history of violence against women, and after this crime, they would become known as the Ripper Rapists. Allison knew that they were going to do something terrible. Like, she could feel it. Once he picked up his accomplice, like, all of the good faith that she tried to give him was gone. So they're starting to drive her out of town. And as the lights of the town become slowly more and more scarce, her dread is, like, growing. And it's darker and it's more isolated, and she can tell there's going to be like less chance of her being able to escape and run away to get help and to scream and be heard. So the men stopped in an alcove, and the men turned and asked her, "Okay, are you going to fight us?" And Allison says in her documentary, she says, "I thought, I don't know how to fight." Like, she was just like, "No, I don't know how to fight." And so the first man, who is Franz, forces her, trigger warning, this is when the assaults begin. So he forces her to have oral sex with him, and he reciprocates and makes these gross comments to her. And then he rapes her. And they were in the backseat of the car, and while his buddy was waiting outside, this is happening inside. So then Franz, like, opens the door because Tien is outside, and he's, like, waiting his turn, I guess. Again, it's just horrific. And he says, "Do you want to make love with the lovely lady or have sex with the lovely lady?" He asks, like he's inviting his friend in. And as he spoke, as they're like having this conversation and addressing one another, that's when Allison realizes that Clinton lied about his name, because they're talking to each other with their first names. And she's starting to think, like, oh no, like, now I know his first name. Like, there's more of a chance now that they're going to want to kill me because they're talking freely in front of me about who they are. So Tian replies that he didn't want to, like, make love. He wanted to fuck that bitch. And that's, to me, the brutality of, like, a man taking, like joy and glee from brutalizing a woman and, like being excited about that, like, that's probably the most terrifying thing to me on this planet. And so this man absolutely terrifies me. What's very strange is that then Franz corrects Tien and he says, you mustn't talk like that to a lady. You should be more proper. Despite the fact this man literally just raped Allison. It's so bizarre. Also, Franz is like a he's disgusting too. So obviously, because he's a rapist. But like later, I'll tell you guys more about what a freak this man is. Like, he's an idiot. Anyways, so then Tien also rapes Allison. We're done with the sexual assault now, stuff now. But they then after that decided to kill her. And so this is when it gets like very violent. They first tried to suffocate her. I think in the documentary, Allison says that when Tien assaulted her, she ended up blacking out, I think, because he was like, he had strangled her. And so she had lost consciousness. And the next thing that she remembers was Tien's hands going for her throat and her bowels evacuating. The men took out their frustrations on the fact that they were unable to suffocate her on Allison by stabbing her at least 30 times in the abdomen. In two different sources, it said two different numbers. So I'll probably say a different number in just a bit because her documentary said a number than All That's Interesting. And I'm just gonna say both of them because I believe Allison knows better in her own documentary, but I'm sure it's from like police reports and other things in the All That's Interesting article. So I'm just gonna kind of reference both. But she was stabbed at least 30 times in the abdomen. And she would later remember that the one who called himself Clinton, which was Franz, specifically wanted to mutilate her reproductive organs. But he miraculously failed. We'll talk more about that later. So as I said before, Tien's hands were going to her throat. She lost consciousness and her bowels evacuated. And as they were stabbing her, she was told later it was around 37 times. So that was what she was told in the hospital. Tien's was the first to cut her throat. She remembers this. Franz pushed him out of the way, so she was witnessing this. So Tien's came to her, slashed her throat, and then Franz pushed him out of the way so that he could do that too. And so she said the moon was behind Franz, and it gave him this ironic halo as he slit her throat 17 more times. And again, I can't say trigger warning enough. She goes through some of the most horrific stuff I've ever heard. And this woman survives, and her outlook on life is incredible, despite what she's been through. So finally, when Allison's leg like twitched, the attackers were done. They had stabbed her in the abdomen 30 to 37 times. They had slashed her throat 16, 17 times. They were certain that like she must be gone. And Allison was quoted to say, all I could see was an arm moving above my face, Allison recalled later. Left and right, his movements were making a sound, a wet sound. It was the sound of my flesh being slashed open. He was cutting my throat with a knife again and again and again. So that is how she firsthand recounts what it was like to have her throat slashed. And she couldn't make sense of what was happening to her. She said it felt unreal, but it wasn't. I felt no pain, but it was not a dream. This was happening, and the man was slashing my throat. So when the men stepped back and they were like, being like, okay, she has to be gone. One asked, do you think she's dead? And the other replied, no one can survive that, which like should be true, but Allison, of course, survives. So they drive away in her car, unaware that Allison was still breathing. They threw her clothes out the car as they drove away. And like she had said, she had felt no pain. I guess she was in shock. But the sound of her ragged breath through her tattered windpipe was horrifying to her. So she knew things were really bad for her because she could hear how bad it sounded for her to breathe. And so that's when she realized that she will die out here in the middle of nowhere. She's not certain where she is. She's laying on like gravel and sand and dirt and like glass. And she said she was sad to think that she might die. But as she seemed to leave her own body, she said she realized she didn't want to give up. So like she started having this like out of body experience, which is probably what saved her sanity at the time. And she was like, whoa. And then she was like, wait, no, I want to survive and maybe do better when I return after this. And so she says she started feeling her body, the sensation of being back in her body, like happen. And as it becomes more solid and real to her again, the first thing is that she had to do, she knew she had to do, was make sure that they never do this to someone else ever again. So she said, I had to at least leave a clue about who did this to me. And so she decided to write the names of her attackers in the dirt around her. So she writes Tiens and she writes Franz. And then beneath that, she wrote, I love mom. So that if she did end up not making it, she like bled out or whatever, the names of her attackers would be near her and her mom would know that she loved her and like was thinking of her. She was afraid she might bleed out and die, but there in the dirt was evidence that she could leave behind. But the longer she laid there, she wondered, okay, I'm still alive. Like maybe I could survive. She could hear the sound of passing cars on a road and wondered if she could make it there and then if someone could help her. And so because she was like, well, I feel like this, like my body feels like it's in pieces, but like maybe if it's close enough, maybe I can at least just throw myself onto the road and hope somebody helps. So this is where it gets really, really bad. So if you've already felt really queasy before, this is maybe the worst that you're ever going to feel during this episode. So at first she felt something wet near her legs. This is how she realized that her intestines were actually outside of her body. She grabbed her shirt that was nearby because they had thrown it out the window, and she used it to kind of hold everything together in one hand. And she started trying to crawl with the other. And so she was crawling across this gravel and cut glass and all the stuff. Allison says, I realized my life was too valuable to let go of it. And that gave me the courage to survive. I knew I was worth getting up for. And it was very difficult for her to get up. And there's more that's worse than this. In my opinion, what I'm about to tell you guys is even worse than the intestine part. So she feared that if she died now, her mother would have so many questions, considering that there was now evidence that she tried to escape because she's now crawling. And so she decided crawling wasn't good enough. She wanted to hoist herself up and try walking. And so, trigger warning again, this is very bad. But as she hoisted herself up, she's lifting her body up off the ground. And for the first time, her body is upright. Everything goes black. And at first, she doesn't understand why. She put her hand up to her throat. I'm tapping my throat. You can probably hear me. And her entire hand goes into a wound on her throat. And what had essentially happened is that they had severed an entire muscle on the side of her neck. This confused her until she realized that the reason for this was that they had nearly decapitated her. She said she realized that her head had flopped back right between her shoulder blades, and that is why she could no longer see. Moving a certain direction lost her connection between herself and her sight, and she would have to be strategic in how she lifted herself up to avoid this. And so what Allison had to do was she took her other hand that was not holding in her intestine, and she essentially lifted her head up and reattached her head to her shoulders and held it there and began walking towards the sound of the road. One hand holding her in her intestines with a shirt and one holding her head into place on top of her shoulders. And also, she's naked at this point. Just covered in blood. She claims it was like someone took her feet and were moving them for her towards the sound of the road. And the next thing she knew, she was at the road and she just fell down. If a car hit her, it couldn't be worse than what had already happened, she thought, which I agree. Like, what a horrific ordeal to go through. So Allison recalls that as I struggled forward, my sight faded in and out, and I fell many times, but managed to get up again until I finally reached the road. And once she made it to the road, she collapsed and hoped to catch the attention of a driver. And as a car approached her, the thought struck her that it could be Franz and Tien's, but it wasn't. However, the first car that saw her sped away. They like saw her and were like, oh, that's a horror movie, goodbye, and like sped away. But soon after that, another car came along. This man's name was Tien Yellard. He was a veterinarian student on vacation from Johannesburg, and he saw Allison in the middle of the road and stopped. His vet skills helped him to care for Allison. He tucked her exposed thyroid back inside her body and called emergency services. In the documentary, she calls him like her knight in shining armor. So the first thing he said when he saw the woman laying in the middle of the road with no clothes on, covered in blood, was something he would never forget. He took her hand and looked into her eyes and said, it's gonna be okay. You have beautiful eyes. I'm here. He said that she couldn't speak and that he could tell she was very frightened and her eyes were bloodshot, probably from being strangled. Her, because she was naked, he covered her with his shirt and just sat there trying to keep her alive and calm and let her know it was going to be okay. So his friend, thankfully, at this time had a cell phone, which was a new technology at the time. Remember, this is 1994. It was a 15-minute drive from the hospital, but it took the ambulance 40 minutes to arrive to pick Allison up. Tien begged the paramedics to drive faster, but he said it was almost like they had decided that she wasn't going to make it anyways. So they were just like, what's the point? Which is infuriating. And this woman still survived. He didn't let go of Allison's hand until they wheeled her back into the hospital where he was like no longer allowed. So he was in the ambulance with her. He didn't leave her side until they were like, get out, you can't come back here. God put me on that road that night for a reason, he says, which I think that's just such a sweet thing to say. And eventually later in the story, he becomes a doctor because of Allison. Like, he was a vet and then he had this experience with Allison and he was like, you know what? I want to help people. I want to become a doctor. So doctors were stunned by how horrific her wounds were, which I'm sure you guys can understand because I'm sure all of y'all are really angry at me for talking to you guys about how extensive they were. They said it was the worst thing they had ever seen. Allison says the entire ordeal from abduction to the hospital was only 90 minutes. And yet I can't imagine, it must have felt like an eternity. So the doctor who worked on Allison had never in his entire career seen something as awful as her injuries. And the brutality of her injuries has stayed with him his entire career. She had been cut from ear to ear, and her trachea and windpipe had both been cleanly cut through, which is what was making that like raspy sound as she was breathing. She was breathing through a gaping hole just between her two collarbones. He couldn't believe that there were more injuries when the doctor who had admitted her pulled back the blanket to reveal her abdominal injuries. So this poor man thought he was just dealing with the slit throat. But then he was like, no, dude, there's a whole other section of her body that's mangled. So not only was she disemboweled, but her exposed organs were now contaminated from being dragged along the ground as she crawled. So she was doing her best and she had that shirt, but of course, like, she couldn't keep everything from getting, you know, messy. And so he feared from looking inside the abdomen that Allison would maybe also never be able to have children. But as I said before, Franz failed at his attempts to prevent that. Though it seemed hopeless, she was rushed into the emergency, surgery. And the surgeon, his name was Dr. Angelov, was incredibly inspired by Allison's strength and the steady hand that she used to fill out her paperwork, even in the face of her horrific injuries. So Angelov says her survival was a miracle. And on top of that, she could have potentially been re-traumatized because they actually came and asked her, like, questions while she was in that state. So the doctors detailed all of her stab wounds and pointed out that despite the high number, the brutality in which all of them were inflicted on her, they all missed key parts of her body that would have otherwise ensured her death in minutes. He even, like, points at, this is where her carotid artery is, this is where all of the stab wounds were. And it's like, it's incredible how close they came. And like, she was not meant to die that night. Like, it was just insane that she survived. So Allison, on the brink of death, managed to pull through and remembered everything about her attackers. So she identifies them in a photo lineup while in the hospital, and the police gave her a folder, and she identified her attackers from the photos inside, writing their names after pointing out their pictures. But unfortunately, like, that was not enough. The case would be stronger if she could verbalize the names of her attackers. And this is why the doctors were, like, so impressed by her, because they were like, oh my God, well, we can't take her breathing out. We can't take the intubation out, because she not only has gone through so much physical trauma, but, like, the trauma is specifically localized in, like, her esophagus and all this stuff. And so the doctors were horrified at this, because he would have to take her tubes out and it could end up harming her further or causing her to stop breathing or even rupture the work they had done to already, like, repair her injuries in the first place. So Allison wrote to her doctor, take it out. And the doctor was like, damn, okay. And so he did. Her first words, according to him, after he took it out were, that's wonderful. She's just such a, like, her disposition, she's delightful. You guys really need to watch that documentary. It's quick, and she's such a lovable person. So she says that, and then she said, my attackers were Franz and Tiens. Her friends visited her and from her insurance job and were just, like, weeping. Like, they couldn't believe how bad she looked. They were horrified. When they got the news of her being attacked, they were just crying in the office. Like, it was clear that these people were all good friends at her job, which is very sweet. And when they were crying, Allison smiled at them because she felt like, you know, I'm okay. Like, I know I look bad, but I survived. And she lifted her hand and said, don't worry, guys, I didn't even crack a nail. And she shows her hands, and her friend who's being interviewed in the documentary is like, and she didn't. Her nails were all perfectly fine. Her body was ravaged by these horrible men, but her nails were intact. And that just shows you the kind of, like, personality and sense of humor this woman has. She thanked people at this time who were, like, sending her flowers and sending her all of these messages and warm, like, get well, like, cards and things. And one of the things she said is, I have life, beautiful people, and you have my heart. That was part of her things. And later she will write a book, and it's called I Have Life. And I just thought that was really beautiful. I love that she phrased it like that. Like, she has life despite what she went through. So recovering from these wounds was tough. They would have to scrub her abdominal wounds until they would bleed to clean them, and also just until new cells would grow over the wound because of the amount of, like, I assume intestine they had to remove, and then, like, how they had to, like, graft and put it back together and everything. And so it was just, like, a tough time to recover. And Allison said it was very, very painful. And so police had connected Allison's case to two other rapes in the last few weeks. So when Franz was brought in and told he was being charged with attempted murder, he was surprised because he had no idea that Allison survived. So when Officer Humpel told him, the reason why is because Allison is alive. He could have been knocked over with a feather. That's a quote from the officer. And then there is nothing I can hide from you because she will tell you everything, he said. And so he took off a ring from his hand and handed it over to the officer. This is Allison's, he said. There was still blood on the ring and they tested it and it was Allison's blood. So Franz is an absolute nightmare. He also had a wife and child at home and he was out doing this kind of thing and then keeping like a blood trophy, like freaking psycho. So prep for the trial was hard emotionally and mentally on Allison. Like you can imagine this, like having to relive what she went through while healing physically from what she went through. I don't know how she did it, but she cooperated and did all that she could, everything she was asked of. Despite her tummy having to heal from the inside out, she came and submitted to photos and further tests whenever the officers asked her to. To avoid Allison having to be in a room with her attackers, which was standard in South Africa at this time, they allowed her to be the first victim to use one-way glass to identify her attackers. And now it's the standard in South Africa to do this, which is wonderful. But it's terrifying that they were just like, yeah, go be in there with maybe your rapist. But for Allison, I guess because she was just so brutalized and they felt so deeply for her, it forced that kind of empathy. And they were like, let's use this glass. And then they started always doing it. She was terrified to do it. She felt like the room was too small and like it made her be too close to them, even though there was glass between them. And she felt like she wasn't warned well enough before it began, but they began the process and they were number 6 and 13. And then she left the small room. The Ripper rapist pled guilty to 8 charges, including kidnapping, rape, and attempted murder. So the judge in this case said that he'll never forget this case, and especially the scar across Allison's neck when she came to give evidence in the duration of the trial. She said, I always thought my neck was a strong feature I had, but I'll never have that now. And the judge said that Franz would stare at him. He looked him dead in the eye during his testimony as if he was trying to intimidate the judge. He claimed to be a Satanist and had tried to be very scary, but I'm sorry, he's just not scary. He's just he's a loser. And I hate when perpetrators try to be like, I'm a Satanist and it's really scary. Because like, that shit doesn't scare me personally, but I find it so cliched to be like, oh, Satan made you do it. Okay, weirdo. Like as if tons of men rape women and brutalize women constantly just because they feel like it. It has nothing to do with Satan. I just think it's, I can't stand it. So while incarcerated, Franz requested a pastor for an exorcism and they had to do it like because he had requested it. It was like part of the law. They had to like allow for certain like religious rites. So Franz tried to use this in court as a reason for his crimes, but he mixed up the two demons that were exorcised from within him, quote unquote, exorcised. And so because he's such an idiot and he mixed up the demons' names, it proved that it was all just a ploy. And I wrote, what a fucking loser. So like, he really did try so hard to like be big and bad and scary and even called a pastor in to exorcise him, but he couldn't even keep his story straight. So the two Ripper rapists were sentenced to life in prison in August 1995, about 8 months after this happened to poor Allison. Franz is a disgusting person who reached out to the makers of the film Allison and asked to do an interview for them. In return, he wanted a signed letter of forgiveness from Allison and a percentage of the earnings from Allison's book and public speaking tours backdated, since he said he believed, quote, what he did to Allison is the only reason for her success story. That is the kind of person Franz is. So when I said that earlier, like, he is an absolute disgusting piece of shit, this is what I was talking about. Quote unquote success story. Go jump off a bridge, Franz. Anyways, Franz's father completed suicide 2 years after his son was sent to jail. It seems like he couldn't deal with what his son had done. And, like, I get it. Your son sucks. So, despite the judge putting in the record that they are a threat to society and should never be let out of jail their entire life, after serving 28 years, both the Ripper rapists were granted parole in 2023 and placed under supervision. I looked into this and it says they'll be in parole and under supervision for their entire life, but that because of a Correctional Service Act in 1998, that South Africa like implemented in 1998, which was 3 years after they went to jail, they had to be considered for correctional, like they had to be considered for parole if they fell underneath the standard of Correctional Service Act. And the article that I read about it said, Franz Dutoit and Tiens Kruger have been admitted into the system of community corrections, whereby they are expected to comply with a specific set of parole conditions and will be subjected to supervision for the rest of their natural lives. And that essentially they did uphold the standard under that statute, and that's why they were released. Just absolutely horrified. Allison wrote that the day I hoped and prayed would never come has come. When I was asked, how will you feel if they ever get parole? My immediate answer was, I'm hoping I will never have to find out. So Allison still suffered from both physical and emotional scars, as you guys can imagine, after this. There is never a healing point, she says. She says there's never a point where you go, I am healed. She says you're always healing forever. So after this, she moved back in with her mom and had a really hard time knowing how to move forward from this. As you can imagine, like once something like this happens and then you spend a year trying to survive, overcome these injuries and recover, and you're testifying against your attacker, once they're in jail and you're healed and everything kind of slows down, like what do you do? So the first time she could have her like a real bath since the attack, after her wounds were healed, she looked at herself in the mirror for the very first time. Like she felt like she saw herself for the first time, she says. And so from there, she started to struggle with depression and apathy, like not caring. She was just totally disconnected from anything that kind of tethered her to life. And she had to remind herself that in the moment that she was dying in the middle of that secluded space on the gravel and the broken glass and her life spilling out physically onto the pavement, she chose life. And in a way, she was now faced with the same choice again. She no longer wanted her attackers to have power over her present life. And so she says, once again, it was like I had to choose life. So despite oral speaking being one of her biggest fears in school and life leading up to the attack, she decided to start sharing her story publicly. And so that was the beginning of her year, or that was the beginning of her career as a public speaker. She says her ABCs are attitude, belief, and choice. This is what she talks about in each of her speeches when she travels around and talks about her incredible story. So she began to travel around the world telling her story, visiting at least 35 countries. She was one of the first women in South Africa to speak publicly about rape in both her home country and abroad. She helped inspire other survivors to come forward and tell their stories as well, which is incredible. So in 1995, Allison won the Rotarian Paul Harris Award for Courage Beyond the Norm and Femina Magazine's Woman of Courage Award. And she was also honored as Port Elizabeth Citizen of the Year. So she had a huge year in 95, bless her heart. And good for her. Well earned all those rewards and accolades. Allison has written a book, I Have Life, which I said before, I think is based on that quote from her thank you messages during that time. And her story was brought to life in the film Allison, which came out in 2016. And as I said, it is on Amazon Prime and everyone should watch it. It is so quick. It's an hour and she's just a delight. She calls it a tale of monsters, miracles, and hopes. She tells it as if it's a fairy tale. And I read some some reviews on Letterboxd that were like, I didn't think it should be told as a fairy tale. This is weird. And I just feel like when a victim tells their own story, they get to tell it however they want. And I think it's really beautiful. And I think it's really important that Allison framed it how she wanted to. And so she framed it as a fairy tale. It's not a normal fairy tale. Obviously, it's horrific. But she can look back on it and she can view, like, before I didn't have these goals. After I did. And look at what I've done with my life. And look at the beautiful people who became characters in my life. And so she calls, you know, the man who saved her, the knight in shining armor. She calls the judge, like, the leader, the protector, etc. And she calls her, like, surgeon, all these names. And it actually is very cool because you see these archetypes of a fairy tale fall into place in the story for her. And I really love that. I thought it was a really cool way to go about it. It captured her spirit and her personality and her point of view on life, which I also think is really important. Allison says her greatest gifts are her two sons that she was able to have despite the evil intention of her attacker to try to take that ability away from her. She said that was his intention, which is what makes this news of having her boys so positive. So Tien, the man who saved her from the road that night, was the assisting doctor on the birth of her second child, which is another beautiful connection that they have. Life can sometimes make us feel like a victim, Allison said. Problems and hardships and traumas are dished out to all of us, and sometimes they can be divided very unfairly. Remind yourself that you do not have to take responsibility for what others do. Life is not a collection of what happens to you, but of how you've responded to what has happened to you. So as the credits of her movie roll, all of the key players in saving her and putting away her attackers get surprised by Allison on set. And it's just beautiful. And so as they're being interviewed for the story, and many of them get emotional because it was so harrowing, they get to see her totally healed, totally happy, step from around the side and say, surprise, I'm here. And they get reunited and they get to hug. And I teared up. The judge, the officer who was the investigator, the prosecutor who would never forget this case, Tian, the man who saved her life and delivered her second baby, her best friend from the insurance job days. And it was just so lovely. It was so lovely to see so much life and love and hope in the tone of this film and in her outlook on life. And that is the story of Allison Botha and her incredible survival and the way that they were able to put these horrific, disgusting criminals in jail. I hope it wasn't too traumatizing for anyone to hear about the horrible injuries that she sustained and the assault that she went through. But I highly encourage anyone who's interested in this kind of thing to go watch this documentary, hear it from her own point of view, and see her and see how strong. And to me, when I hear stories like this, the strongest thing a person can do is move on with their life and find joy. And that is absolutely what Allison did. She is incredible. And I just feel like more people should talk about her story. I couldn't believe that I had never heard it except in passing, like on TikTok. So thank you guys for sticking with me through it. And I'll see you next time.